Thanks. It's funny, I don't often get introduced as being directly from the dark side. But there is a sense in which I think it is true. I don't know if some of you may know Bill Curtis, who was at the Software Engineering Institute in charge of its process program. In fact, some of you may think he's also from the dark side because of the CMM and all that. Bill once said to me, he was an advisor on a paper I wrote as a graduate student, and one of the things he said to me once was, if you really want to screw up a software project, put an MBA in charge of it, right? And since I train MBAs, one of the things I like to try to do in what my job is I like to make that less true. I don't think I've made it untrue yet, but we're working on that project. So I'm going to talk to you today about something that's a little bit probably far afield, or at least it's going to seem that way from what you've been talking about the rest of the day. And I understand from talking to the organizers of the conference that this is what they were looking for, something that was kind of out of the box compared to the other things you might have talked about today. However, I do feel that it's important to note that this is in many ways a special audience for the kind of talk that I'm going to give, the work that we've been doing. Because if you read my 2003 book with Lee Devon called Artful Making, this work was very much launched into being as a result of trying to understand what was going on with the agile movement in software development, trying to understand why the structure of software development would be changing and why it would be changing at this point in time. And you'll see later why we have some theories about why it's all happening now, as opposed to maybe 20 years ago or 20 years from now. So that'll just be a part of what I want to talk about. Now, what I'm going to encourage you to do, there's kind of two parts to this talk. One is about sort of globalization and competition and the need to innovate. Another part is based directly on our research interviews with people who are acclaimed innovators in their particular domains. Some of our cases are about agile software developers. I don't actually have video from those interviews with me today. I have interviews with designers and people who make airplanes and so forth. But one of the things I will encourage you to do as I talk is think about the ways in which the work you do relates to what these people are doing. Because I would suggest that the work that you are doing can be interpreted more broadly as pioneering work in trying to figure out how value will be created in an innovation economy. So you may not conceive it that broadly. When I've had conversations about this with people like Kent Beck, Jim Highsmith, Alistair Coburn, and so forth, I find that although they think this is all kind of interesting and they are interested in it to the extent that it helps them justify extreme programming practice or agile practice, that they aren't necessarily, I guess Jim Highsmith may be an exception to this, aren't necessarily that interested in the fact that it is more broadly important, these ideas. But my co-author, Lee Devon, has this expression he likes to use. He talks about ideas in the air, that sometimes in a time there are ideas in the air. And we've used this in our book, our Artful Making book. We were talking about when the 19th century was becoming the 20th century, and the ideas that were in the air had to do with mass production, had to do with standardization of work, and so on. Those were ideas that people didn't have good words for, didn't know exactly how to talk about, didn't have good ways of justifying, didn't have ways as good as the ways of the justifications of the old ways. So I mean, it's kind of a parallel to, I think, where agile is today, that you have this sense that you're onto something, but the vocabulary somehow isn't quite as respectable as the traditional vocabulary yet. Here we're talking about the shift not from the 19th century to the 20th century, but from the 20th to the 21st. The ideas that are in the air are not about mass production and standardized work. They're about iteration and innovation as a form of value creation. They're about creation of value out of difference rather than value out of efficient similarity. So I'm going to try to elaborate on a lot of that. Let me begin in what may strike you as an unconventional place. In fact, it's chosen because it is an unconventional place. I'm going to try to convince you that there are global implications of the production of a certain kind of trash can. So let me introduce you to a very special trash bin that comes out of Denmark. This is a trash can. It's a company called Vip. Have any of you seen products from the company called Vip? Okay, well, it's a reasonably small company. There are products like it in Germany. There's a company in Germany that's a major competitor. I think it's called Wesco. Basically, the idea here is we have very high-end trash bins. That's the core product, but also other upscale home and bath products. So we're talking about a company with an annual growth rate of 30 to 50%, and they make these kind of retro-looking trash bins. Now, some of them are quite large. Some of them are like as high as your waist. Some of them are quite small. The large ones sell in some markets for as much as 500 euros. They're very well constructed. They function extremely well as trash bins, but there's no way the function accounts for the price, right? That there's something else going on here. This bin, the 4-liter bin, it's about this big. And it costs, in the United States, it costs about $250. Which, you know, even with the exchange rate today is a fairly chunky price, right? By the way, the company has a toilet brush that also sells for $250. So you can have a wonderful aesthetic experience in your bathroom with these toys. So I'm joking. But the fact is that this company is growing. And this company has not even genuinely penetrated some large markets. So it doesn't seem like Germany has fulfilled its, I mean, they certainly haven't fulfilled their potential in Germany yet, it appears. And they haven't even entered the U.S. market, really. They have a few retailers that offer their products in the U.S. So we must contemplate this question. This is particularly interesting if you're a business school professor. Well, why are people willing to pay 500 euro for a trash can, right? It is a trash can. It is a category of object that we ordinarily associate primarily with functionality, only with functionality. We often think of trash cans as commodity objects. It would be possible to obtain a perfectly well-functioning trash can at a tenth of the price. And in fact, we reckon, they won't tell us, but the manufacturing costs of these are far less than the actual selling price. So the question, why are people, and I know, I see skeptical eyes in the audience, but there are always amid the skeptics people who are kind of saying, I think I'd like one of those, right? So somewhere in this audience is a prospective VIP buyer. Somewhere there is someone who's going to go out on the web this afternoon and look for this product, right? But the reason is that this is more than a trash bin, at least as the company offers it. So let me show you, for example. This is, let's see, there we go, perfect. Yeah, just this is what I'm showing you here is what happened in Copenhagen in spring of last year. There's a department store in Copenhagen called Illum that is very posh, right in the middle of the city. It has, usually its display windows are filled with Armani, with Louis Vuitton, with Prada, you name it. For 2 weeks during the spring of 2006, yeah, so it was last year, their windows filled up with trash cans. Often trash cans displayed alongside fashion. So we see here a trash bin as fashion item. Very sort of edgily displayed. This is my favorite, trash can and chains, right? Yeah, so highly conceptual. What you're looking at is a project where the company asked famous designers to use their trash bins as a blank canvas, design these pieces. They were then auctioned off for charity, but they got a huge splash out of it. And you can see they worked very hard at the visuals, at the positioning of the thing, so that they've basically positioned this as much more than a trash bin. If we go yet one more step forward, we go from trash bin as fashion item to trash bin as art object. This is, some of you may read Danish. I don't, so I've translated it here for the side. This is by the way, their toilet brush in special edition Python Green. It so happens that Python Green was the color of the ball gown that the wife of the founder wore the last time the two danced together. So there is a story wrapped around this Python Green color. Everything this company does is a story. I see deeply skeptical eyes here. This trash bin appeared at Louvre, and also in the spring of 2006. This newspaper article says the famous Danish VIP trash bin will be seen from April 24th at the Paris Louvre. It's the only trash bin invited to be an art object at the Louvre. There are other trash bins at the Louvre. So it's important to distinguish. And there was also special music composed for the installation. So you can see, now there is a bit of, I mean, at least a bit of irony here, right? So it could be that the people who buy these are the people who kind of get the joke, right? I mean, it may be that some people buy it because they think it's beautiful. Some people think because the idea of a 500 euro trash bin that's been in the Louvre is just too cool, right? So who knows? But we're building a lot of sort of rich texture here around this trash bin to make it so that what we're buying is not, strictly speaking, the function. We're not only buying a trash bin here. So there's some things as a business school professor that I like to observe about this VIP example. One of my colleagues, Michael Porter, some of you may have read some of his books. He's probably the most prominent strategy professor in the world. He says there's basically two ways companies compete when they do it successfully. Sometimes companies try to do more than one of these at a time, and then they get confused and lose their way usually. You can either compete on what he calls cost leadership, or you can compete on what he calls differentiation. Cost leadership is when you say to your customers, buy mine, it's just as good, but it's cheaper, right? And so there's a long, proud tradition in most countries of things that you buy because they function as well as the other things, but they're also cheaper. We think of these as commodities often. Trash bins would ordinarily fall into that category, probably. You're looking for the best one that you can buy functionally for the price. The other strategy called differentiation is the value proposition to your customer there is, buy mine, I know it costs more, but it's because it's better, right? So in other words, you should be willing to pay more for my product because my product is not like anybody else's product. It's special in some way. And so VIP is going about as far as can possibly be gone from the cost leadership strategy in the direction of a differentiation strategy in a category that's ordinarily thought about as a cost-based strategy. One of the things to note here is that better, what we mean by when we say buy mine, it costs more, but it's better. Better isn't just a matter of function, right? This is an item normally valued maybe exclusively for functionality, but it's valued instead for something more amorphous. The people in the design industry like to use the word meaningfulness, that what you're selling is something that's meaningful. A lot of people now talk about the experience economy, that we're selling an experience. We're not just selling a trash bin, we're selling an experience that surrounds it, that's partly composed. Oh, I got another very skeptical reaction there when I said that. But the fact is, this company is selling a lot of trash cans, right? So whatever they're doing, this is kind of interesting. And I'm going to suggest to you in just a minute that there's a reason that it should be particularly interesting to all of us in operating from developed economies like the economy of Germany or anywhere in Europe, the US, Japan, Australia, and so on. So what we really have here, if you think about traditionally the way we thought about products, that we had this sort of tangible functional component and we kind of smeared on the top of it something we might have called marketing that was intangible, meant to give the thing meaning. So we focus mostly on the thing, the product, its function, its technology, and so forth. But up here, there was this sort of intangible component. We called this marketing. We called this product development and operations. And this is comfortable to us, right? And typically, the cost in the margin looked something like this, where the cost was a much larger chunk than the profit margin. Now, when you look at something like VIP, you see quite a different creature, right? You see something where the intangible chunk of it is by far the largest chunk. Now, I want you to also, as software developers, think about the implications of a broader sense of what I mean by intangible. When I talk about trash bins, I'm talking about, you know, fashion and art object and so forth. But this is arguably a description in a way of software, right? That software is more, a much larger component of intangible. Even the word meaningful is reasonable, I think, when applied to software. That the degree to which software functions is quite important, but the functionality of a software product is not the only criteria. It's not the certainly not the only thing that differentiates a software product. It's also things, you know, it's not just that it sort of satisfies the requirements, it's the way that it satisfies the requirements or something like that. Now in this world, we see the actual manufacturing costs are a relatively minor matter. The profit margin is considerably higher. Now one of the things that this doesn't reflect is that there's a lot of other overhead involved in this kind of a business model. There's the overhead involved in positioning your trash can as a fashion item. There's all of the development work that gets done on a software project and so forth. So that typically doesn't go into manufacturing cost, but it does have to be figured into the business cost at some point. So another company that operates this way that some of you may know is Bang & Olufsen, another Danish company that makes very, very high-end TV, stereo, audio products. People pay, I'm going to use US dollars because that's what I have closest reference to, people will pay $13,000 for a Bang & Olufsen flat screen TV. The roughly comparable Sony version costs maybe $3,000. It's about design, it's about a lot of things that are not tangible. Now why is this all happening? Well, first of all, let's notice another difference, that a lot of what we talked about historically, if we talk about the ideas that were in the air around the turn of the last century, mass production and so forth, most of that and most of the business logic of the 20th century has been about cost reduction. The real miracle of the Industrial Revolution was that it reduced dramatically the cost of making things by standardizing, right? So it drove down unit cost to a point where everybody could afford a car, for example. A great example of this is the Volkswagen, right? The people's car that was supposed to be affordable, but also the Model T. One of the things I want you to notice about this VIP example, and also I think about many of your software businesses, is that we've changed the game in a business sense, that we're not now as focused on the cost side, we're now more focused on the revenue side. We're trying to get people to pay more money, we're trying to get more profit margin, and that is more the focus of our interest. In Michael Porter's terms, we're playing a differentiation game and not a cost game as much anymore. Doesn't mean you can completely forget about cost, doesn't mean that at all. But I mean, this is an example from the sort of Gilmore and Pine experience economy work. How much will you pay for a cup of coffee? Well, the cost of production is probably, I'm making this up, I'm not sure, 0.15 euro. Not very expensive to produce a cup of coffee. At a corner lunch stand, you might pay half a euro for it. At Starbucks in the United States, you might pay $1.80, and at the low current exchange rate, those are strikingly similar. They weren't the first time I used this example, which was like 2 weeks ago. At a trendy cafe in Paris or in Venice or somewhere like that, you might pay 5 euro. And of course, what are you paying for if you're paying for five euro for a cup of coffee at a Parisian, fashionable Parisian cafe? You're not paying just for the coffee, right? And so this is kind of a key to all of this. Probably everybody knows Walmart. Walmart is the largest, according to sales, largest company in the world. Revenues in excess, approaching $300 billion annually. And of course, the way they've done it is by selling things at everyday low prices, selling basic items that are really cheap to U.S. consumers who have been gobbling them up. But they're having trouble lately. The problem Walmart is having is that it has a competitor, and I don't think this competitor is playing much in Europe, but they have a competitor in the US called Target. Target has this idea that they call design for all. And what they've done is signed deals with a lot of famous designers, and they're bringing items to their shelves that are still reasonably priced, but that look really cool, right? So they're not sort of full-blown VIP trash bins, but they look cool, they cost a bit more, and most important to Target, they produce better profits because they can price them still reasonably, but higher. And so what's happening to Walmart is, yeah, this is a very thin margin business, this everyday low prices business. It's a penny business, right? You're trying to get a few pennies of margin out of everything that you do, and you're being hyper efficient in order to do it, and you're undercutting other people's prices. Well, Target is saying, go ahead and undercut our prices. We're going to charge slightly higher prices for better products. And the customers are coming, and the shareholders are noticing that Target is getting better profit margins in its financials than Walmart is. Walmart has responded by trying to create upscale brands. Walmart creating upscale brands, think about that, right? Now, so Walmart has created a brand called Metro 7, for example, which is men's clothing. George is children's organic cotton clothing. Problem is, you don't go to Walmart if you're looking for organic children's clothing, right? It's the discount store. And so this has been a real problem. I know it's kind of hard to read, but that's a cover of Business Week. And what it describes, it says Walmart's midlife crisis, that Walmart has struggled mightily to try to even get a few more pennies out of its customers, to get customers to think of its brands as special in any way whatsoever. So you know, one of the interesting questions for a business school professor, and I'm going to argue that it's relevant to all of us, is why is it that a small company in Denmark can get customers to pay $500 for a trash can or 500 euros for a trash can, but Walmart can't get a few more pennies out of its customers? Well, some of this is about the difficulty of switching strategies, but some of it also is about sort of a trend, an idea in the air, a difference between the way we've successfully competed in the past and the way that we will successfully compete in the future. Walmart is destined to have some serious difficulties, I would suggest, not only because of this problem, because they're so strongly mired in a cost leadership strategy, but also because their customers are having lots of difficulties these days. The ones that most often go to Walmart are the low-income customers. So there's a competitive dynamic at work here, and it's a competitive dynamic that I know is on the minds of people in Europe as well. How many of you, just a side note here, how many of you have seen a company's website called despair.com? So yeah, this is the kind of crowd that like those posters, right? So despair.com, for those of you who haven't seen it, you may have seen the posters that some of the people from the dark side hang on the walls that say things like excellence, and they show a picture of a mountain climber, and underneath they have an inspirational saying, and it's supposed to make your team function better when you see the mountain climber achieving and you read the, despair.com makes parodies of these posters, and one of, I like to use them in presentations. This is one of my favorites. It says, Discovery, a company that will go to the ends of the earth for its people, will find that it can hire them for about 10% of the cost of Americans, right? And of course, we can modify that, right? We can modify Americans to be Germans, and we can. If we do that, we probably have to change 10% to 5%, right? Exchange rate and all. But the fact is that this is a competitive dynamic at play here, because if you're going to be a cost leadership company, you're going to have to be heavily invested in this part of the world. And even then, it's going to be hard, because sooner or later, the Chinese and the Indians are going to get their act even more together, and they're going to start producing brands. And we're going to buy those brands, not even realizing that they're owned by Chinese investors. There's already some moves in this direction. The European brand called Rover now belongs to a group of Chinese investors. I assume many of you may have known that. a purchase partly, I think, from BMW, right? I think BMW was involved in that deal. Also, another deal like this that this crowd will be familiar with, Lenovo bought a bunch of brands from IBM, ThinkPad, for example. So we're going to see, we're seeing experiments right now in these companies based in places like India and China. And actually, the ones in India have been pretty successful in marketing business brands. So TCS, Infosys, Wipro, and so forth are doing pretty good business, growing very rapidly. So the question then becomes, in the long run, if you're Walmart, if you're competing on cost, can you really do it? Can you compete on cost against a new brand that's going to come out of China and India? Some people, by the way, say there are people who argue that China's not going to succeed at this. They say that it's too recent in China's past that a Chinese company that has a name and is trying to create brands today, it's too recent in their past that they were called clothing dye factory number two. And in fact, that is true, that they do have a lot of baggage, so to speak, that comes from that era. But I will tell you, more and more students from China are appearing in my classes at the Harvard Business School, and the ones I see are very smart and very fast learners. I wouldn't be comforted too much by any ideas about sort of historical barriers. So I'm going to say, in a word, no. In the long run, it's going to be very difficult for firms based in high-cost areas of the world to compete on cost against firms based in low-cost areas of the world. There's a 1-to-10 labor cost ratio. As you may hear people argue, yeah, but that's going to change as their standard of living increases. Yes, true. But there's 2.3 billion people in India and China combined. That's a pretty serious labor supply. And there will be shortages in certain categories, but there's a lot of labor in China and India. It's also not offset by a decline in productivity. One of the things people say is, yeah, they're cheaper, but they're not as good. Some of them are actually pretty good and increasingly good. So we see here, this is part of the reason I would suggest why companies like VIP are playing a very different game. If you're VIP, you're starting a company in Denmark, it doesn't occur to you to try to say to your customers, buy mine, they're just as good, but they're cheaper. That's the kind of thing that will occur to somebody in China or India. Instead, you want to try to convince people that your products are special, that they're better in some way. Now, I think this accounts, I live in Copenhagen right now, and I think one of the things that surprised me about Copenhagen is that you walk into a houseware store in Copenhagen and you might think you would mistakenly turn into a museum shop, right? That the museum shop at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, that everywhere you turn, there are items with lots of design content. Now, not all of these items are successful products. Some of them are not going to produce, they're not going to win in the long run. People are not going to be willing to pay that much for them, as much as they need to be paid to maintain those businesses. But we see a lot of efforts at buy mine, it costs more, but it's better. And I would suggest to you there's deep structural reasons for that. That we see suddenly we've gone from less than 600 million people in the global market economy in before 1989 to a situation now where we have about 6 billion people in the global market economy. There are only a few enclaves now where the market economy does not reach, Cuba, North Korea, and so forth. And it's all connected by this wonderful network, not just an information network, although that one's incredibly important, but also a transportation network that gets better and better. So something very big has changed, I suggest, and here's just an example. How many of you know the company that makes Ray-Bans? Does anybody know that the company is not actually an American company? The company that makes Ray-Bans is an Italian firm called Luxottica. The Luxottica is traded on the New York Stock Exchange. Some of the sunglasses are made in factories in China. Others are made in Italian factories, but they're made by a largely Romanian workforce. So we live in a world where everything has become much more connected, and we are seeing a sort of reformation of business strategies and so forth. Quote here from Business Week. This is from the CEO of a company called Micron Tech that some of you may know. He says, I don't have to hire one more person in the U.S. I don't have to invest one more dollar here, and we'll be just fine. So he's working a lot in Taiwan and China and in India and so on. This is from April 23rd of this year. So there's some facts we might as well face, okay? The internet bubble has come and gone, but the worldwide telecommunications infrastructure it created remains and continues to improve. If work can be routinized in some way, chunked, standardized, digitized, automated, why would a profit-seeking business choose to do it in a high labor cost location? It's just water flows downhill. Companies try to achieve profit. Sooner or later, this makes a big difference in every developed economy, in every developed economy firm in some way or another. One of the things that I'm seeing more and more of is that low-tech offshore can trump high-tech onshore. And we see what I call technological regression. So some companies are replacing sort of 10th generation, very efficient high-tech IT systems with five guys in Manila retyping things because it's a better deal. They get a financial gain out of it. Now, you could question the wisdom of that in the long run. I think there's a pretty good reason to question the wisdom of that in the long run. Nevertheless, it is happening, not everywhere, but in some cases, that low-tech in Bangalore can out-compete high-tech in Poughkeepsie, New York, or Heidelberg, Germany, or wherever. This is from the Lisbon scorecard from 2006. It says the integration of China and India into the world economy will roughly double the global labor force. Europe will not be able to compete in labor-intensive industries and services. So this is the backdrop for why we have to innovate, I would suggest. So we must innovate because non-innovative work won't happen here. Won't happen in Japan, Europe, the US, Australia. Innovative work, by the way, doesn't have to happen here. The Chinese government policy is precisely constructed to allow Chinese firms to learn from Western firms who are offshoring to realize cost advantages. So the idea is you offshore because you have to remain cost competitive. The expertise about how to run factories, how to develop software leaks into the surrounding geography, and before long you have locally based competitors made up of people that Western firms train. And this is, I'm not saying this is a bad thing. It's just going to happen. So research and development, many of you know, lots of research and development is now going on in India and China as well. The fact is 2.3, 2.4 billion people makes up a pretty deep talent pool. Now, some of you may know the book by Thomas Friedman called The World is Flat. One of the things he reports in there, and it's a report from Microsoft Research. At Microsoft Research, they have a research center in, I think it's in Beijing. And one of the things they like to tell themselves when they recruit, is they like to repeat to themselves, if you are a one in a million person in China, there are 1,300 others like you. Now, I like that quote, because if you use that same metric on a lot of other countries, it sort of gives you a real sense of the depth of talent pool issue, right? So I live in Denmark right now. Denmark has lots of companies that compete in the global markets. Very successful country in that sense. 5.5 million is the population. If you're one in a million person in Denmark, there are four or five others like you. And in the long run, that has all sorts of implications for immigration policy and so forth. What I keep telling them in Denmark is they need to lure the smartest students from China and India to be trained in Denmark, figure out which ones are the really smartest, and convince them to stay. Now, this is, of course, something that figures into all sorts of political arguments and so forth as well. That's way outside my area of expertise. But the fact is, this talent pool issue is a big deal. I don't know if any of you saw on the web, on YouTube, there was this slideshow for a while that was called something like Did You Know? Or one of their little statistics that I quite liked, it's not originally theirs, is they talk about how there are more honors students in China than there are students in the US. Just these numbers start to mount up. Conclusion, we need a better innovation ability, because it's the best way to create value as we move into the future. So what does this mean? Let's talk about what it means to practice innovation. And this is where We're going to go into, I'm going to go into the research that we've been doing here, and I want to encourage you to notice some of the similarities in the practices you're hearing about here from some of the world's best researchers, our best innovators. But I think you'll discover, I think you'll, what you'll hear is that the work you are doing is very much akin to what they're up to, and therefore very relevant to this innovative challenge that I've been describing. Some preliminaries, just very quickly, what do we mean by innovation? Very broad definition in our research. It's just activity that results in novelty that is valuable. Something new, something not seen before that is valuable. Most software development projects would qualify. They're creating new functionality, new capabilities, and they're valuable. Outcomes that must be discovered, either because they're entirely new, because they haven't been experienced before, or often, and this is a case, as we all know, in agile software development, it's one of the major justifications. Sometimes what we need to do, the customer requirements, are difficult to discern. So we have to discover them through the process in which we engage them. We have to figure out what it is that needs to be made, often at the same time that we're making it, which is kind of a description, I would say, of the Agile movement. Some more on innovation, just want to point out that when you are creating value through innovation, surprising can be a good thing. You know, historically, if I used to work for Ford Motor Company, if a car rolled off the assembly plant and it surprised us, that was not a good thing, right? But in this world, in this kind of a process, surprising can be a good thing. Similarly, or conversely, predictable can be a criticism in this world. Something that's predictable is not something that somebody's going to pay 500 euros, or is not a trash can that's predictable is not something that's going to command 500 euros from a customer. So, you know, sort of going above and beyond mere functionality means predictable is not necessarily a good thing in all contexts. Surprise doesn't necessarily mean a quality problem. And so we've studied lots of different areas where this is true: design firms, media and entertainment companies, drug researchers, product designers, consumer electronics firms, video game publishers, and industrial process improvement efforts. Actually, agile software developers is also another group that we've studied, but I don't have results here from that. So we asked a couple of big questions in our study. If we look at innovation across a wide range of activities, including, by the way, art, the arts, will we find that there are common principles, processes, and practices that are used by the best, the most acclaimed innovators across a range of fields? Do we see things in common? Second, in what conditions should you design and manage the work the way expert innovators do? In other words, there must be some cases where innovation is not the way to create value. So let's not claim that it's the solution to the world and everything. Let's be careful about where you should innovate and where you should not. Okay, so this, I'm going to go now into some of the things we're finding, and I'm going to kick through them and illustrate some of them with interview data from our study. So the first thing that we find in a real foundational aspect of this will not seem surprising to this crowd, probably, but I think it's worth noting because it's so foundational, that the shape of reliable innovation, the shape of the processes that are common to almost all of the innovators that we've talked to is iterative, not sequential. In other words, the waterfall is not the approach to innovation, as if this group needed to be told, right? But I mean, this is a picture, this isn't the waterfall, although you'll recognize it as very similar to the waterfall. This is about car making. This is from research by Kim Clark, who was the former dean of the Harvard Business School, and Taka Fujimoto. They're describing how automaking works. This is taken from one of my own cases about a company called Trilogy Software. Some of you may know Trilogy. They made, I believe they're still around, although I'm not sure what they're up to these days. They made a configurator that everybody used for a while, a rules engine, if you like. They developed software, and this was before Agile really caught on. They were kind of doing Agile before it was called Agile. I think you would say, that they, you know, they use this very interactive with the customer approach, where they would have one of their developers talk to a customer for a few minutes and then go away and create a real quick, ugly prototype and come back. And of course, the customer thought it was horrible, but the conversation that then proceeded was good, was very valuable, much more valuable than those long interviews that used to go through as part of the waterfall requirements gathering phase, right? And then they would do it again and again and again. And the whole idea, as you know from Agile, is they're gonna do 29 of these in the time it would have taken to switch one system on here. And it's gonna have a lot of favorable features. It can follow changes in requirements better. It can better discern places where the requirements were not captured correctly and so on. And I don't think I have to go on with all the list of benefits of an iterative structure with this group, because you all know this from the work that you do. So as I said, this isn't gonna be a surprise to Agile advocates, but the thing I want to point out to you is that the importance of iterative practice extends far beyond software. I'm going to show you a video excerpt now where we're going to see a whole range of innovators talking about their processes. And I think you'll see that they also are engaged in what might be called an agile approach. So at least in the sense of the process structure. So let's try this. And we're gonna probably have to experiment a little bit with sound here, so I apologize.
What I do not do is to have a finished, let's say a finished drawing or a finished color study to start working, let's say an etching from. Because really that event has already happened. I'm in danger of merely copying that onto the etching plate.
I do very little drawing ahead of time that specifically relates to a sculpture. Maybe some quick sketches, but never finished plans. That all happens in the middle.
You can do a certain amount with paper, but then it's not the same as working with the material.
We designed the airplane in 3D, digital data. Sometimes it gives you the illusion that you really understand how everything's going together, how it fit, what the best production plan that goes along with that is. And when you actually start building it, it's a different story.
Looking at a plate does not tell you what's really there. Only printing it can tell you.
I would much prefer to sketch with material than with paper and pencil to actually work out how something goes by twisting, moving, and...
And so I see us moving much more to the large-scale prototyping. And again, you don't have to use real parts, expensive parts, like they mentioned, we use plywood.
Ray Arm models, and we have model makers that create even better models than we do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the way to do it.
And they bring those, you bring those to...
Yeah, I drive over every time, and I have them.
In your car?
Yeah.
Okay.
I wasn't intending to do a piece of work. I just wanted to explore the mark making, the altering the surface of the wood. All of a sudden, I began to realize there's a landscape in there.
King Sergius non-traditional tools, scrapers and sandpaper. And there's an incidental line that ran through here. So this is the beginning now. Now I can see landscape. And the next piece would be this one here, which is the very first two colors. And then from that, it develops into this one here. Now we can begin to see the land area. And that develops then into this, or these two here. And the landscape is beginning to form.
In the first instance, they're pieces of cardboard to illustrate a thought, a range of thoughts that can be assimilated by several people within in the company here. Mm-hmm. To sort of start it off and get together around the idea as such. And then we might make, depending on how accurate we are in our thinking, we'll go on making a few very loose sort of sketches, I would call it, still using paper and cardboard, and go over some more hardware type of things where some of the technology is being utilized, where we try it out to see that it works all together.
We have a great technology out there now called stereolithography that lets us make some pretty complicated things from an engineering drawing and be able to use those in a very inexpensive, quick way. And then we get to go tri-storm. Like you go try it, doesn't work, it's okay because you're just working through a prototype.
So there's a back and forth,
lots
of back and
models are back and forth.
Okay.
Yeah, every Friday.
More or less every Friday.
And you bring a new prototype with you every Friday?
No, not that much, but almost.
try something new and you like it, so then you try something else and add that to it. So it's a building process where you try new things.
I was very pleased with the results because a lot of them were marks that were not intended to represent colour in landscape.
I don't really know where I'm going when I start.
Okay.
And that's...
And that's a good thing?
For me, it's a good thing.
You may suddenly realise that something has happened we've not intended that is contributing to this process, and then everything can change.
Okay, so there's a lot going on in those videos, right? Much of it you will recognize. I mean, one of the things that's going on is the role of technology. Some things that we couldn't prototype in the past, we can prototype now because of technologies like stereolithography. Do people know stereolithography? It's basically, it allows you to design something in a CAD screen, send it to sort of a 3D printer device, and very quickly you have a physical object that is the one that you designed. You can immediately see if it's too light or too frail, too feels wrong in the hand, whatever. But I mean, you can also hear a lot of the things that are being said here are quite radical in sort of a traditional waterfall frame of mind. I don't know where I'm going when I start, and that's a good thing, is kind of radical, perhaps even to some of us. But the fact is, one of the things that they're pointing out is that if you start off thinking you're going to a particular destination, and you're too vehement about that, it may prevent you from going to destinations that you discover along the way would be better. And so there's not only, one of the things we tend to do in software development is fixate on the idea that problems emerge during the process that were not anticipated. Well, opportunities also emerge during the process that are not anticipated. And so one of the things an iterative process structure allows us to do is seize the opportunities as well as avoid the problems. There's, as you know, all this discussion about scope creep. But scope creep is a good thing in some instances if it involves seizing an opportunity that's a very valuable one. And not only is it a good thing, it's sort of an inevitable business thing. Business managers need to go where the firm needs to compete. And if the requirements change because the business environment changed, well, it's kind of an abstract argument to say, but that's not what you told us. So anyway. So let's talk for a moment too about so basically, if we in our research we distinguish between innovative making and industrial making. Simple distinction: innovative making is when you don't or can't know where you're going in advance. You might not be able to because the customers can't tell you effectively, or for a whole host of other reasons, because the customer's requirements are changing in time or whatever. In those cases, and this is kind of borrowing some terminology from Jim Highsmith. Exploration and production are combined, right? You're figuring out what to make at the same time that you're making it. The process is iterative. You learn more from doing than from a lot of planning. On the other hand, if you're in a world where you can and do know where you are going, then you might as well separate exploration, set up your requirements, and then manage to milestones in the traditional way. It's just more efficient that way. So we're not talking about iterative approaches, agile approaches everywhere. We're talking about them for a certain subset of applications or business problems where it's not possible to know in advance the full feature set or something like that. This involves, of course, if you're industrial making, extensive planning before you do. So prerequisite cost conditions. Two things you have to be able to achieve to work iteratively, to work agilely. First, you must be able to iterate cheaply and rapidly. If it costs too much to try something, then people are going to force you back to the waterfall because you can't afford to try it too many times before it becomes prohibitively expensive. Two kinds of cost, by the way. Cost of rearranging things to make a new kind of thing, and a cost of what might go wrong from the new thing that you make. So just to use a very caricatured example, if you want to make a new kind of airplane, you have to rearrange the factory so a different kind of airplane will come out. That costs something. If the airplane then takes off and crashes into a residential neighborhood, there are some costs associated with that too. Two kinds of costs. Both of those have to be low enough before you can work in this way. Also, there has to be a reason to innovate. In other words, there has to be a reason why the desired objective might change during the process. There has to be a potential for valuing different outcomes that emerge from the process, or there's simply no justification for it either. These conditions are, of course, not always met. Now to my theory, my hypothesis about why Agile is happening now. Well, you heard the guy from Boeing here talking about how stereolithography and things like that had changed the shape of their innovation process. Well, this is the story, basically. Often innovation is made possible by technology that drives down the cost of iteration. In software development, there's a whole bunch of stuff we've seen emerge in the last 15 years or so that helps us reduce the cost of rearranging things. So rapid prototyping, rapid build, components, a whole range of things that help us put things together cheaply and quickly. Programming environments. But there are also ways of testing, automated testing, testing-driven design and development, lots of methods, technologies, and so forth that make it possible for us to cheaply discover when something isn't working. And also, I think not to be underestimated in importance is version control. Some of the version control and configuration control technology that we've seen emerge that allows us, in effect, when we screw up, to undo it very quickly and easily. These things make the cost of iteration low enough. So I'd suggest this may be why agile methods have emerged in the last 10 years or whatever it is, that the technologies that are now available make this way of working possible. We should note that technology developments almost always drive method changes. So when we went from the 19th century to the 20th century, the standardization that allowed us to reduce unit costs so dramatically were driven by new machine tools and new forms of steel that would hold tolerances so we could produce interchangeable parts, so that we could make a plan that says we want to make a part this big and then repeatedly make a part that big. That was not a capability the world possessed before about that time. And without that simple technological capability, you can't structure things in mass production. Everything is craft, because all of the variations have to be adjusted to by an expert craftsman as he's making something. But once you can hold those tolerances, the whole world changes in terms of the process. Now I would suggest, in what you might call an innovation revolution, you're also seeing the enabling by tools, but they're tools like simulation. Like, they're tools that drive down the cost of trying things, of trying new things. The cost of iteration, if you like. So, the cost of design, call it whatever you like. The cost of trying something new, the cost of producing a novel outcome. Producing something that's different from what you did last time. So now I'm going to show you a series of other common attitudes and philosophies and methods that we see in our research. I think you may recognize this one. We find that people who are innovators often rely on incidental events happening. Accidents are not necessarily a bad thing in this world. I'll talk about this a bit more in a minute. So.
It might be the cloth texture hitting the surface of the canvas that you want to keep. I mean, that's totally a random accident.
So the copper plates provided to us were highly polished. They used to scare the heck out of me. And then one day I thought, this is it. I'm going to declare war on the subject copper plate. Into the car park, face down, and kicked it around the half an hour. I came back, prepared the plate, and printed it. I thought, right, this plate's on its way.
These cases, like this one, and yeah, that one down there, I'll hit them with a stick, a piece of 1x2 or half inch, and snap it at that rim any time, half an hour after I make it. In this case, the whole piece came out with it. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's good, I thought. That's fine. You can see where the stick hit, and it's just, but I snapped it off quickly and didn't, just barely flicked it at it and pulled it out. Oh, that's quite wonderful.
So, I mean, this is kind of, I mean, these are all like artist examples, and we see artists more openly relying on this process, but the fact is that when you're creating novelty, when you're creating new outcomes, you have to get the novelty somewhere. You have to produce variation. Now, often we produce variation that's the variation we can think of. It's intentional variation. We decide, well, I think if we made it this way, it would be better. But one of the things the history of innovation shows us quite clearly is some of the most important innovations happened when we got outside our expectations. So if you look at the history of invention, you'll discover, for example, that many, many important inventions were made by accident. One of my favorite examples is Röntgen, who invented the X-ray, you know, so you can see your bones, right? He accidentally exposed a photographic plate to a radiation source and he'd placed his hand in just the right position that when he developed the plate, he could see his bones. Now, as it turned out, there are others who had also noticed this, who were doing similar experiments. Their reaction was to move the photographic plates further from the radiation source so it wouldn't happen again. Röntgen's reaction was to invent X-rays, right? So this is one important innovation capability, the ability to look at things that are unexpected, I know in your own work, test results, and see things that might represent potential new innovations, new approaches, as well as problems. In business, we're so often oriented towards the unexpected being problematic that we lose our capacity to notice favorable variation that's not intended that produces favorable outcomes. But there's lots of examples. Everybody knows the story of the Post-it note that was not supposed to be that. Everybody knows the story of Viagra, which was supposed to be liver medicine or something, and it turned out to be, whatever. Yeah, so anyway, there's lots of examples of this. Now, another thing I want to show you here, because I think it is part of the agile mindset. One of the things that kind of surprised us in our research is we found that when we talked to really good innovators about failure, that it was very difficult for them to even use the word, that they really kind of reject the idea of failure. And so one of the things we started doing in our interviews is pressing them on it. So I've edited this pretty densely so we can see more of it. But imagine me in the background going, but that's a failure, right? And as you'll see, they just won't admit it. They won't call it a failure. They want to call it a learning experience. They want to call it, so anyway, you'll see here. But I think there's something very important in their way of thinking about this.
You have to try a lot of different things and be open about it. And of course, you can see some of them doesn't work, but there's still a lot there because maybe if you combine it with something else, it could be a better idea. There comes something new, and it fits the whole the story better.
Well, I think about the cost of the paint that's underneath that was no longer part of the painting. It was a necessary part, and has become a vehicle towards the final painting. Because for an artist to say that colour is not correct there, they have to put it down and judge it in relationship to other colours or on the form. And then they know which colour to put on top. So is that wasted, really?
If you have covered a lot of ideas, I think that you're getting better at the end. Mm-hmm. So we can't, it's not waste of time. You can always use some of it, and then maybe you can use it for other things or whatever. You learn a lot when you like making mistakes.
So there's not a great consequence if something goes badly. Basically, what you've lost is your time.
Yeah. Yeah. But you may have gained an insight, and so the time was spent on that instead of actually having a final object. So the time might have been well spent, even though there was nothing to show for it other than experience.
But if this idea was I didn't like before, if you combine it with something else, you get something new, maybe.
Sometimes things turn out to be blind alleys or dead ends. Yeah. They don't work out. is that expensive sometimes?
Yeah, but I think that's a part of the game.
But you wouldn't really call that a mistake. You would just call that a necessary step.
It's a process. It's part of the process.
Even if it seems expensive to you, it might be worth it.
Yeah, I wouldn't call them necessarily problems. They're things that have to be overcome. I mean, this is the challenge.
So you think of those as potentially useful, even though they don't seem to work in the way they originally conceived. So they're not really failures.
No.
So you see, I mean, and I hope there's a reasonable analogy to the work that you do. I mean, you do a lot of versions, you do a lot of prototypes. You can't magically conclude, as some managers might be prone to, that it would be better or that it is possible for us to go to from version prototype number one to version prototype released. That the sort of idea that efficiency is going to arrive by without any sort of intervening efforts at and without any intervening efforts that don't work very well. So I mean, there's this expression from the design firm IDEO. They say, "Fail faster to succeed sooner," and I think this is kind of pretty consistent with the philosophy of much of the people that we're talking about here. Okay, this one is, I apologize for the video and sound quality of these. This is the one that's particularly low level, so you may want to turn up the sound. This one is potentially radical for this crowd. I know one of the ideas of the iterative, or the agile movement, is that you sit down closely with customers and you work closely with customers. One of the things we have found consistently in talking with great innovators is that they want to understand customers, but they don't necessarily think asking customers immediately asking a customer is the best way to figure it out. That they're all profoundly worried about customers telling them things that aren't actually right about what the customer wants. So you'll see that they don't use customer feedback in a direct way. Now maybe some of this is ringing, sounding familiar to you, but here we go.
You don't go out asking, you know, end users, what do you feel about soap dispensers? We look at it in this house and say, this has the right feeling, it has the right quality, it has the right expression, it has the right materials, we like it. Therefore, there must be people outside this house who likes it as well.
So it's not our job just to completely follow instructions. Our job is to interact and to voice an opinion, but to do it respectfully and know when we should be backing down and when we should be pushing. And that's the, you know, at the end when I said, you know, when someone appreciates what it is that we did, if you do that with the right degree of finesse, then they'll appreciate you and they'll be back for the next project.
This toilet flush, she had an idea of how it should look. So she started by making the product. She didn't start by researching the market, because if she had done that, she would find out that there were 10,000 toilet brushes in the world already, and she showed it to some of our good dealers in Copenhagen, saying, do you like this? Yes, they liked it a lot. What will the price be? At 1,000 Danish kroners. And they were almost fainting, because it was so expensive. They said, you cannot sell a toilet brush at 1,000 kroners. And now it sells more than this very nice design Philips Dark toilet brush, which costs 1/4 of the little brush.
It's a brand new wood, and it's made of apples. So it has
beer.
A little fruity apple taste. But it's not like red apples, it's green apples. And we actually put the strong citrus of an apple inside the small letters. They actually came back and said, we would like a little more strong colors. And they said, you remember that we were sitting tasting? And if you want to do a beer for the finest beer, you have to go for the original taste, the flavor, and everything. You don't compromise on the beer, so don't compromise on the look.
I see. So you can inspire them back.
Yeah, of course, because it's important. And if this was on this one, it was blue, it would be a wrong taste. It's very, very important that everything is right. So we tell them the same story.
So they said to you, we want stronger colors, and you convinced them they were wrong.
Yeah.
to put it bluntly, we don't do any markets, what do you call it?
Research.
Market research, we don't.
Don't believe in it?
Personally, no. Because I don't believe the customer knows what he wants. We just have to come up with something which he can't resist. This is the difference. That's the issue.
So it would actually impede your innovation process if you listened too closely to the customer who doesn't really know.
You would do exactly what he asked you to do, because it's much easier.
Mm-hmm. Probably cheaper.
Most certainly cheap, because it would be something that is already on the market, in principle. Mm-hmm.
Just staying in this house, not listening to anyone. Of course, we have to go out and get some feelings and personal impulse. But you have to be very much sure of what you think, your own feeling. A lot of customers tells us that we could have made a soap dispenser just by scaling the toilet brush and put a pump on the top. You know. But you know, it would have been awful to just make a copy paste of the bin and make it a soap dispenser. So of course you listen to them. They could have some very good input, but then you have to as well, you know, distillate some of the not good things apart. And that, well, I think they had a need for a soap dispenser and they liked the design. So why don't just make a mix up of those two? And they sell a lot of bins, so why just make a bin for soap dispenser? If we just make a big bin like a hanger or soap dispenser or a toilet brush, you know, everything, then we will not be here in 2 years, you know. People might be interested in the beginning, but then
this is about feelings. Motion, it has to touch you when you see the marketing or whatever it is. It has to touch you, and if your company is driven about business guys in their 50s with an MBA in the design industry, and you're based your decision on focus groups, you think you're going to get ahead? I don't think so.
So you can see this is a somewhat, I think it's a somewhat radical view about customers, but I think it's not it's not totally different than your world, and that sometimes I'm sure customers do say things that turn out not to be what they really want. I mean, you know, the guy who says it most pointedly, David Lewis for Bang & Olufsen, easily one of the best designers in the world. So, you know, he may sound like he's sort of arrogant and clueless, but again and again, he's designed things that that customers actually do find irresistible. So, anyway. It's an interesting, you know, to the extent that what you guys are doing is representative of this kind of an innovation process, I think it's interesting to think about why, you know, to what extent what these guys are saying about customer feedback also applies to your world. And I don't know the answer to that. Let's see, so I'm just checking time, and I'm thinking that we'll do one more of these and then finish. I have a lot more video. Not all of which I intended to present, but so one of the things that we have found is that when people think about how they save things, and one of the big traditions in the IT industry and the software development world has been about reuse, right? So reuse means we have a piece of code, we think we can use it somewhere else, so we put it aside. We find that people who are involved in innovation save things. But maybe it's more related to saving. A lot of you are involved in the pattern language movement. It's more like patterns than it is chunks of code. So you'll see. I'll just let you. These collecting behaviors are also quite interesting.
I used to have, yes, an enormous warehouse. But not anymore. I had to move.
I take a lot of pictures of everything. My holidays go to places where I can take photos. I just take photos of everything.
Yes, foliage, make it separate. And I might make little sketches.
Yeah.
This is where we stayed, Fern Hill. In Port Antonio, Jamaica. Little business guides, the people I meet. Situations where my bum was pinched by a local lady in the market.
I use this mold material or a dental mold material. And I can make impressions in the field.
It was just sort of where you kept those old ideas that you were ready to
try. Yeah, rubbish really to most people, but you know, that's little bits and pieces that you know. Somehow I got this thing that We did that a little bit, and we didn't.
If you see a lot of things all the time, you start thinking about them, even if you work with something else. You have it lying in your back head, and suddenly people are doing something else in another project, and they come up with, I have a good idea for this.
And I don't know how I'll use this. But I've got it.
But it's like somebody who paints drawing a corner and not knowing how they use
yes.
it, just thinking
yeah.
it's interesting.
Yeah.
yeah. Okay. Yeah.
He must have an extensive library, didn't he? So.
Yeah.
And where do you keep them? On a computer?
On a disk.
You have them organized in a special way?
No. I remember almost all of the pictures I took. So when you're working with something, you say, I saw that before, or something similar, or something. And you go through all the pictures and you get some more ideas, of course.
So the way you use these images, if the filing system were too good, it would keep you from stumbling
over
the casting ideas.
Yeah.
So you don't want too good a filing system.
No.
You kind of, I mean, what you're describing is the equivalent of sort of piles.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And you have to go, maybe we find some other things, and that's nice.
How do you work with it? Yes, I first, if I go to a museum,
These are just mountains of sketchbooks.
I put some watercolors when I come back, and I always work with drawings. And it's like I once stayed by some friends in Mexico, and he was a musician, and he was playing the scales all the time. And you had to practice, or at least to do the things so you are really prepared. Because I don't believe that inspiration is something which you just say, now I'm inspired, now I go and do the things. You have to do it, and then suddenly it comes to you.
Do you ever get frustrated because you know there's something and you can't find it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's annoying, but then you kind of find it and fuck it.
Do you go back to these? Do you know exactly what's in them? Or how does... No. Or do you get mad when you don't find exactly the thing? That
no,
you
no, no, no. No. I take it as it comes. And you know, as a painter, I have sniffed too much turpentine, so I don't have a very good memory.
So this is, I think what's important here is to notice the differences between what they're doing and what we might call sort of standard reuse. That they're not storing them efficiently. They don't want to store them efficiently because they want to get more ideas when they experience the things that they're going through. They're collecting them for the purpose of getting ideas more than they are for actually reusing them. They're never intending to actually, you know, cut and paste into a new place. There's a sort of a practice or inspiration dimension to it, and so on. Let me summarize now. And this goes a bit beyond some of the video that you've seen. These are some of the characteristics that we attribute to industrial practices. Sequential process design, in other words, a waterfall. An inclination to minimize process variation using things like statistical process control. You want to minimize unuseful outcomes for efficiency's sake. You want to give the customer exactly what he or she asks for. You want to reuse because you don't want to reinvent the wheel. You want to achieve predefined, externally verifiable objectives. Repeatable is competence building and a good thing. You know, think of SEI use of that word. Control through target setting and feedback. Mastery can be codified, captured in formal, repeatable process descriptions or methodologies. These are ideas that we find are associated with industrial settings and industrial practices. Innovative practices, on the other hand, have iterative process, openness to unintended variations as a source of novelty, an unwillingness to call unuseful outcomes failures, a belief that the customer is not always completely right, although it's not a disregard for what the customer wants. Knowledge management is about collection, not reuse. They want to reinvent wheels. They don't repeat. They don't like to repeat. They want to do something different. Control through, and we haven't talked about this one, but control is achieved through practice, through iteration, not so much through constraint. Expertise is involved in saying what finished is. This one we also haven't talked about, but one of the things you'll know well from the software development world is it's hard to decide when you're done. That you can always decide this is a release that's going to market, or you could go one more. Even when you release something, you immediately begin working on the next thing that will be part of a future release. So this is not a characteristic of industrial products. You know you're done when you're done with a car. Mastery is often tacit, not codified, and acquired through experience or apprenticeship. I have one more, despair.com poster. I'll read it because I know some of you can't see it. It says, motivation. If a pretty poster and a cute saying are all it takes to motivate you, you probably have a very easy job. The kind robots will be doing soon. So with that, I will just conclude and say thank you for having me. It's a delight to come not so far away from where I live now. If you want to know more about this, there's a 2003 book called Artful Making that I wrote with Lee Devon. And I'm also working on a new book that should be available next year called Reliable Innovation. And in both of those books, you'll see all sorts of evidence that the Agile movement has been an inspiration to the work that we're doing. So thank you very much. I hope I haven't gone too far over. So I will see you again somewhere. Thank you. Yeah.